All right, the marshal can call the court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Jessen, Judge Smith, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
Good morning and welcome to everyone. Excuse me. This is our second of two oral arguments today. Court file A201513, a certiorari appeal in the matter of Enbridge Line 3 replacement regarding the Section 401 water quality certification. Even though we're appearing via Zoom today, our rules, as counsel is aware, remain the same. Each side here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The court has been advised, since there are multiple parties in this case, that Mr. Strand, on behalf of appellant, will use the full 15 minutes of the allotted time, and that respondents will split their time, 8 minutes for Mr. Farrell on behalf of the MPCA, and 7 minutes on behalf of Ms. Brussman on behalf of Enbridge. Counsel can correct me if I'm mistaken about that agreement. Otherwise, we are recording the proceedings. Those recordings will be made available pursuant to our rules. And we would ask, for purposes of that recording, that at the beginning of your arguments, you identify yourselves for our record. With that, we'll begin. And Mr. Strand, on behalf of appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Strand with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and I'm appearing on behalf of all of the petitioners, in this case, all of the relators. This is the third or fourth appeal involving Enbridge's proposed Line 3 crude oil pipeline project. This particular case is a challenge to the decision of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the MPCA, to certify under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act that the Line 3 project will not violate state water quality standards. The state's water quality standards and the rules governing 401 certifications are located in Minnesota Rules Chapter 7050, but of course this decision is also subject to the general requirements in the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act and the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act that prohibit permitting projects that will pollute, impair, or destroy Minnesota natural resources if there are feasible and prudent alternatives available. The petitioners contend that the MPCA's decision does not meet the requirement of those rules or those statutes, and that therefore their decision should be vacated and the issue remanded for further proceedings. One initial comment, we understand that the court's decision on a parallel appeal from the Public Utilities Commission decisions will come down on Monday. A large part of the MPCA's certification decision is based on the agency's position that its authority is limited by what the PUC decided. So if those decisions are reversed, or any of those decisions are reversed, it's likely to have a direct impact on whether or not this 401 certification decision can stand as well. But for today, we're gonna simply operate on the basis that the PUC decision remains the law of the case and proceed to the issues of whether the 401 certification meets the legal requirements.
So Mr. Strand, if I may, and thank you for that clarification. I know that you're appealing from the certification, but because the Corps has issued a permit, I'm struggling with the mootness issue, which you addressed, I know, in your reply brief. So I'm kind of going back to that general rule that when a reviewing court cannot grant effective relief, we're to deem the issue moot. So there are a lot of cases people have cited from other jurisdictions. What's the best Minnesota Supreme Court or Minnesota Appellate Court decision you can point us to would help us define cannot grant effective relief? Because that seems to me to be the core issue here.
Well, Your Honor, I think let me address the basic question. A 401 certification is a precondition for getting federal permits. Any federal permitted project needs a 401 certification. If there is not a valid 401 certification, then there are not valid federal permits. We've seen it in just recently with respect to the PolyMet case, where a U.S. District Court judge here in Minnesota found that the that 401 had been violated because the Corps had not given the appropriate notice to downstream tribes. And so it withdrew the 404 permits that it had already issued at that point because of the violations of 404. We would anticipate that.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, so we believe what happens if the 401 certification is found invalid, there is effective relief because it will make the 404 permits invalid. But we think by operation of law, the Corps may take some kind of a formal decision. But even if it just increases the odds that the 404 certification or the 404 permits will ultimately be found invalid, that's relief. That counts. That matters to the ultimate outcome of this. This project can't go forward without the 404 permits. The 404 permits can't go forward without the 401 certification.
And if I may, Mr. Strand, here, because I did not see any, you know, clear law, maybe you can point me to it, that says it's automatically would make the 404 permits invalid. But I understand what you're saying. Maybe it increases the odds, and pointing to the Fond du Lac case kind of shows that certainly it could lead to the suspension, but is could leading or increasing the odds, getting back to my original question, mean that we cannot, that we can grant effective relief? Is increasing the odds enough?
Well, I think it is, Your Honor. I can't point to a specific case that talks about increasing the odds, but what we're talking about here is mootness is sometimes described as standing on a timeline. We've been injured in fact by the construction and ultimately the operation of this pipeline. That only happens if these permits are valid. Those federal permits can only be valid with a valid 401 certification. If that precondition is eliminated, that will, will lead to the reversal of those permits as an by operation of law. If the court doesn't do it, we think a court will do it. But I think the fact that we've eliminated at that point a precondition for those federal permits grants us a greater likelihood that our injury in fact, which is caused by the construction or operation of the pipeline, won't happen. It'll eliminate our injury in the course of time. And that means that the situation is not moot. This is something where the court can grant effective relief. Exactly how much? Well, maybe remains to be said, but it won't be zero. It'll be somewhere between zero and automatic rejection of the 404 permits. Anywhere along that spectrum is enough to allow this court to proceed to the merits.
And just then, Mr. Strand, just to end, well, for my sake, I don't mean to cut off Judge Jessen, of course, but just to make clear, are you saying that we don't need to decide with certainty what the impact with respect to the 404 permit would be in order to have this case not be moot for us? Does the mootness depend on the outcome with respect to the federal agency permit?
No, I don't think you have to evaluate what the impact necessarily or how it will go down with respect to the 404 permits. Even if it simply gives us another reason for a federal court to reject those permits, that's not nothing. If it leads to the automatic rejection of those by operation of law, that's certainly significant. If it leads to the Army Corps of Engineers doing as they did in Fond du Lac and withdrawing the permits, that's significant as well. This project can't go forward without those permits. Anything that increases the odds that those permits will not be valid helps us in terms of trying to address our injury in fact. So let me turn to the merits issues, Your Honors. We've articulated basically four reasons why the 401 certification does not meet the requirements of state law. The first one is their failure to consider alternatives. Both under the state's anti-degradation rules, as well as MEPA and MIRA, if there are alternatives available that are less environmentally damaging, permits can't be granted. The PCA, if Enbridge had applied for the 401 certification first, and if MPCA had the first shot at this, they would have been obligated under the law without question to consider the possibility of routes that would not impose as much of a risk to Minnesota's freshwater resource.
Mr. Strand, can you talk more about procedurally how that would happen and how that works in the context of this multi-agency review? Because the PUC, I think, is the agency charged with doing an EIS and all of the information, gathering information that would inform decisions, including relative, I think, to the MPCA's decision. So considering how would it go first to the MPCA prior to a request for the PUC from its determinations and then the whole EIS process?
Well, one, you know, the goal should be to try to harmonize the statute, give effect to all of the different statutes and rules that apply here. If Enbridge had applied for a 401 certification first, and they've known for a decade that to get this project built, they're going to need a 401 certification from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. If they'd applied for that first, then the MPCA would have, as part of its obligations under its own rules and under MIRA and MEPA, to consider whether or not there are feasible and prudent alternatives. They, in fact, in this record, have articulated and described feasible and prudent alternatives. They then could have either denied the certification because the route wasn't consistent with that obligation, or they could have granted a certification but conditioned it on certain parts of the state being off limits at that time.
Would there have been, Mr. Strand, would there have been an EIS performed that would inform that MPCA decision if it had not yet gone to PUC? I guess that's my question. I'm trying to understand how MPCA would make its decision prior to having that review being done.
Well, the environmental impact statement comes first. Under the Environmental Quality Board rules, that's assigned to the PUC, but that does not that EIS then applies to all of the agencies that have to make decisions. So if the RUS, or not the RUS in this case, if the PUC had prepared an environmental impact statement that met the standards of the law, that would provide a basis for the MPCA to go forward. The order, what we're saying is that the order that the agencies decide shouldn't determine which laws apply. In other words, to give effect to both the MPCA's rules and to the PUC's rules, we think that the MPCA should be allowed to consider whether or not alternative routes somewhere else would reduce the risk to what they acknowledge are some of the most valuable and most fragile freshwater resources in the state. Then the PUC could have made its routing decision based on those conditions. That way you get the effectiveness of both. The PUC makes the final routing decision. The MPCA gets to impose conditions on their certification to discharge their responsibility to preserve and protect Minnesota's water quality resource. So that's how it would work. The EIS would come first because it has to come before everything else, but then the agencies can proceed. They can proceed in parallel, they can proceed in different order, but it shouldn't be the order that the agencies decide that determines what law applies. At the first one, that's the law that applies and all of the other laws have to give way to that. That's not a result that is consistent with the principles this court's articulated many times, that the goal is to harmonize statutes, not to have one trump the other. So that's alternatives. The second issue we have is with the refusal to consider the biological standards. The MPCA decided that it would base its certification on a review of some of the state's water quality standards, not all of the state's water quality standards. And they decided to ignore the ones that are, I think, really most important. The biological standards, where you do an assessment of aquatic life and make a determination whether or not the project is going to interfere or those aquatic life standards that have been established. The briefs say over and over again that the MPCA can pick parameters of concern and choose to focus on particular standards rather than others, but there isn't any textual basis for that. There's no basis in the rules for doing that. In fact, it's contrary to what they've said over and over in their own rulemaking, that the old physical chemical standards, like total suspended solids, are a poor proxy for actually getting in there and assessing the biological situation. They've said that over and over again. And so for them to retract that position, go back and say that really checking the turbidity of the water is going to be enough for us to certify that there'll be compliance with water quality standards, we think just violates those rules. Same with number three, which is wetlands. You know, clear rules, have to avoid the impacts if you can. That means moving it away from the wetlands. MPCA says it can't consider that. Same problem as with respect to the alternatives. The standard is also expressed that if you go to compensatory mitigation, then you have to make sure that all of the compensation, the restorations happen before construction starts. They push that decision off until sometime after construction is completed. Again, an express violation of those standards. And the final problem with the decision that the MPCA made is it's a refusal to consider operational risks at all. The Section 401 of the Clean Water Act expressly contemplates consideration of both construction and operational impacts.
But Mr. Strand, doesn't the 404 process deal with discharges during construction, and another permit would deal with the operational risks?
Well, there's a dispute, Your Honor, about whether or not the Corps' 404 jurisdiction scope of review is limited just to those discharges. There's litigation going on about that now. We don't agree with that position, but even if that were the case, the whole point of 401 is to go beyond the Corps' scope of review. The purpose of 401 is not to provide an advisory opinion to the Corps of Engineers as to whether or not the Corps' decision is consistent with federal law. The purpose of 401 is to go beyond those federal requirements, make an assessment whether or not the project's going to comply with state water quality standards. So the scope of 404 review for the Corps and the scope of 401 review by the state should be different. That's what's contemplated by the statute. That's what I think Section 401 was intended to do. Ignoring operational risks ignores the elephant in the room. Obviously, the primary concern with this is about spills, particularly in areas where the bands have hunting, fishing, gathering rights. To ignore that is hardly doing what we expect the MPCA to do under the authority that it has. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strand. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Judge Floyd, I have one additional question, if I may.
Oh, go ahead, Judge Jessen.
And this relates to an issue, Mr. Strand, you weren't able to get to, and that's whether or not the burden of proof was improperly shifted during the ALJ proceedings, at least. I want to focus on that. So when I look at, I think it was five issues that referred to the ALJs, from your perspective, were those fact issues related to the ultimate issue of whether replacement line three will comply with the state's water quality standards? I mean, don't they mostly directly go to that? That's my question.
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. You know, first of all, the burden of proof is on Enbridge throughout the process. If, for example, Enbridge can't convince the MPCA that all of the state water quality standards will be met within the year that the statute contemplates, then the result has to be that the application is denied. Otherwise, if you accept it because you've run out of time, you've effectively shifted the burden of proof to somebody else. You put the risk of non-persuasion on the environment, not on the applicant. We think that's a mistake. The five issues that were sent to the ALJ were interesting, but they were not the fundamental issues that are at stake in this particular appeal. We think it's the legal determinations that the PPA made prior to that really created the problems that led to this decision being unlawful.
One follow-up, if I may, Judge Flory.
Go ahead.
If they weren't the fundamental issues, then if we find that, you know, it was improper to shift the burden of proof onto realtors during the ALJ decisions, then we would not need to reverse and remand if that was the only problem we had.
Well, I think those issues are, you know, it's sort of like they're necessary, not sufficient. You know, you have to make if you limit the scope of the review to just the decisions about whether or not what particular crossing method ought to be used at particular bodies of water, which is what the effectiveness of what the PCA ordered to the ALJ basically was. You do have to, Enbridge does have to prove that. You know, the ALJ and MPCA put the burden on us to prove that what they selected was not appropriate. And so that would justify a reversal. And we would go back and we would have to have probably another hearing on those particular issues, or at least a review of the evidence that's been persuaded. We do think the flaws in the 401 certification are much broader than that. And I think that's been the focus we've tried to bring to this argument.
All right, seeing nothing further, then we'll proceed to respondents. I'm not sure who intends to go first, Mr. Farrell or Ms. Brusfin.
I'll be going first, Your Honor.
All right, you'll have 8 minutes.
May it please the court. Pete Farrell on behalf of the respondent, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I have very limited time this morning, so I want to focus on two main points. First, this court should dismiss the appeal as moot because the court cannot grant the relators effective relief. Whether this court's decision will have any effect depends entirely on the discretionary decision of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
So, Mr. Farrell, if I can turn to that issue right away, why is Sierra Club not a persuasive case on this? In Sierra Club, the federal permits had issued. Everyone had to go under the federal law, both under the from the Army Corps and also from FERC. And yet the Fourth Circuit reviewed the state law issue of the 401 certification and said, we don't need to decide with certainty what happens at the federal level. There's enough here as sort of an antecedent decision that might affect a later federal licensing decision. Why is that not persuasive on the issue of mootness?
I don't think it's persuasive for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, that is a standing case. The analysis is a little different. As Mr. Stan noted, these justiciability doctrines, mootness, standing, ripeness, they all deal with whether the court can grant relief given a particular snapshot in time. And I think in the Fourth Circuit case, the arguments there were really focused on redressability, the idea that there was some sort of abstract injury that could potentially be redressed.
Right. It was looking at the same point in time, I think, as we're looking at now, and it's whether it's redressable.
I think, respectfully, Your Honor, I think the analysis is different. The mootness inquiry really focuses on whether there's been an intervening event that fundamentally alters the nature of the court's ability to grant effective relief. And that's the situation that the court is in here. And we know that. It's really undisputed that even if this court were to give the relator everything they want and vacate the 401 certification, that decision will only have effect if the court chooses to give it effect. And so there's very real risk.
I don't know that that's undisputed. I mean, I think that is disputed, whether the choose to, from my what I understand from opposing counsel. But even so, Sierra Club talks about, I mean, even that the reviewing court on the state law issue doesn't have to decide with certainty what's going to happen at the federal issue, either as a matter of law or a matter of discretion, because it might have, it doesn't have to be that certain that in order to do the state law review.
Right. And look, Your Honor, I agree that this court's mootness precedents say that these rules are not applied automatically. There's some discretion built into these doctrines. But I think what should compel this court to find this case moot is that there is a very real risk that this decision will just have no effect. It will be a purely advisory opinion. This court has dismissed two similar Section 401 certification appeals as moot in similar circumstances for that very reason. And that's why the issuance of the federal permit really is an event that affects the ability, fundamentally alters the ability of a state court to grant effective relief. Let me very briefly—
Those two, if I may ask, are those two dismissals you're referencing in your briefing?
Yes, they are. So the Thanks. MCEA, okay. Yes, they are. And just to be clear, they're the MCEA case and the Vessel case, 1998 and 2009. And then there's also the Texas Court of Appeals case we cite in our brief.
So not to belabor the point, Mr. Farrell, because I know your time's limited, but how does the federal court action challenging the 404 permit fit into this analysis on mootness? Because they denied a temporary injunction, finding that there's an unlikeliness to succeed on the merits, but should the 401 certification be reversed, couldn't that also have an impact on the federal court litigation on the 404 permit?
I suppose it's possible, Your Honor, depending how the federal court litigation plays out. I mean, the federal court has already found that the petitioners who are challenging the 404 permit are unlikely to succeed on the merits, so I don't think that situation is likely to arise. But again, I think the fundamental issue here is we're doing a lot of guesswork about what the Corps is going to do, what the Corps is going to do. That's an unusual position for this court to be in. And so for that reason, I think that the sound principles of appellate restraint dictate that this court should dismiss the appeal as moot. Let me use my remaining time to briefly address one of the merits issues. I just want to say at the outset, overall, the court should affirm the MPCA's decision to issue the 401 certification if it reaches the merits and does not dismiss the appeal as moot. The certification decision is based on MPCA's careful evaluation of a robust administrative record. The main issue that the relators focus on has to do with the route. Let me tell you why MPCA's decision on route was proper. What's critical for the court to understand is MPCA determined that the route selected by the commission was the only feasible alternative as that term is defined by rule. The relators really downplay the fact that there's actually a rule that defines feasible alternative. And what that rule says is a feasible alternative is one that's legal, has supportive governance, something that can successfully be put into practice to accomplish the task. The route designated by the PUC meets the plain meaning of that definition. Even if the court were to disagree with me on that point, and I think it's plain under the language of the rule that the PUC routing authority satisfies it. If the MPCA's interpretation is at least reasonable, then deference doctrines are kicking in, and the court should affirm the decision for that reason. And the reason that the MPCA determined that the route designated by the commission was the only feasible alternative is because the legislature has chosen to vest routing authority in the Public Utilities Commission. There's an extensive regulatory framework that governs the routing process. Our brief walks through the relevant statutes and regulations. And that regulatory process was followed here. MPCA participated in those proceedings. Let me address what I think was Mr. Strand's main point, that there's some sort of forum shopping going on here, that Enbridge was trying to game the permitting process by going to the friendlier PUC first before it came to the MPCA. I just don't think that makes sense. And here's why. As Judge Smith noted, environmental review is with the PUC. And under state law, no state permits can be issued until environmental review is complete. So it doesn't make any sense for a project proponent of a large pipeline like Line 3 to come to the MPCA to get a 401 certification where there's a one-year time frame on the decision. It makes sense for the project proponent to go to the PUC, which is responsible for environmental review, which is responsible for issuing the need and route permits, and then come and get the additional state permits it needs once the route is designated and once the need of the pipeline is determined.
So I'm not entirely sure, Mr. Farrell, that I said that the PUC is responsible for environmental review. So I will I don't know that I said that. I guess my question is, does it necessarily have to, what's wrong with the argument that that both things could, that MPCA review could be plenary, including alternative routes, if the applicant just went there first, had the EIS granted to be performed by the PUC, but then made its decision? Is it just the 1 year thing that interferes with that, or is there something more substantive? The rules don't really tell us where the applicant has to go first. Are you saying it's necessarily implicit somehow?
If I may, Your Honor, I see my time's expired. I think
you can answer the question, Mr. Farrell.
So a couple of responses, and to the extent I was misquoting you, Judge Smith, I didn't mean to. What I was trying to convey is that the PUC is responsible government unit under state law for environmental review for a large pipeline like Line 3. So that's the point that I'm making there. And so again, I think what's important for the court to understand is, I guess the sequencing couldn't be different, but I think it's a hypothetical in search of a fact pattern that's just never going to arise, because in the environmental process, alternatives are always going to be considered. That's through the EIS process, and MPCA in fact participated in those exact proceedings here. 24 alternative routes were considered. MPCA was an assisting agency. By the time the 401 certification process kicked in, MPCA applied its rule and determined that the route designated by the commission was the only feasible one. And let me just conclude on this very brief point, which is, I think it's important for the court to understand, while the MPCA conducted its review within the route designated by the commission, if MPCA had concluded that within that route, state water quality standards could be complied with, it wouldn't have issued the certification. What MPCA concluded based on this record within the route designated by the commission, that state water quality standards could be complied with. That's why MPCA issued the 401 certification based on its expert review of a robust road. that decision should be affirmed if the court reads the merits.
Judge Flory? Oh, go ahead, Judge Jessen.
If I may, Judge Flory?
Go ahead.
I just had one quick question on the water quality standards compliance. So the Clean Water Act, as I understand it, requires a state to assess in this certification whether the project violates state water quality standards. Where's the place you can point us to that says that the MPCA has the ability to pick and choose between which water quality standards they rely upon? Or are you just relying upon the fact that we generally give deference to the agency?
2 points, Your Honor. We're not just relying on general deference. I think what's important for the court to understand is under the 401 certification rules, the state rules, the locus of 401 review is the anti-degradation standards. Those anti-degradation standards are drafted in broad terms. What they require the agency to do is to consider whether the existing uses of the waters that will be affected by the project are going to be protected. And so the agency does have wide latitude, and for good reason. We want our expert environmental regulators to be able to focus in on what really matters, to structure the review to focus on the parameters of concern that are most likely to result from the project. This court, I think, reached that same decision in a similar case, the SDS general permit decision from 2009 that's cited in our brief, where it said, where effectively what the court said, the procedure, form, and content of this type of review does give their agency broad discretion. I don't think it's blind deference. I think the record shows that MPCA took a hard look at the parameters that were most likely to result from this project.
May I, Judge Flory?
Yes.
Thank you. So, Mr. Farrell, I want to understand what the MPCA's position is relative to the 0.0150, which I think is the reg that's at issue, that the agency didn't perform the indexes of biological integrity or require those as required under 0.0150. And I'm wondering, I know there's reference in the brief to, well, that's not mentioned in the anti-degradation standards, but I don't quite understand that yet, because I don't think the wetlands rule is mentioned under the anti-degradation standards either, but you still look at that. So is it that 0.0150 doesn't apply, or is it that it procedurally doesn't apply, or that you can look at that? Can you explain to me what the agency's position is relative to the narrative standards in that rule?
So in that rule, the agency's position is the indices of the biological integrity that the relators are relying on, they're not intended to set project-specific regulatory parameters. So the agency is not going to require the preparation of those IBIs as part of the permitting process. So what the MPCA does is it focuses on the parameters and the numeric and narrative standards that are tied to those parameters when it conducts the review of a 401 certification request. And so there's necessarily some latitude given to the agency to structure the review. It doesn't look at the IBIs as a permitting standard. They're really, those indices are a classification. They help the agency make more precise classifications of class two waters. And here, you know, there was no dispute that all of the waters crossed by Line 3 project, they're class two waters. Those are waters protected for the use of aquatic life and recreation. So MPCA applied the specific standards tied to specific pollutants that protect the waters for those uses. So MPCA
where would I find those specific standards? What rule are you talking about there when you say it look at specific standards?
So I think if you go to MPCA's addendum, pages 12 through 13, that lists the parameter of concern, and it also ties each parameter. For example, like total suspended solids is the main pollutant of concern here. The standard that MPCA applied is in Rule 7050-222. And so that's a specific numeric criteria that MPCA looked at. MPCA looked at other standards. So like, I think one thing that's a little confusing is the relators sort of in raising the argument up a level, they say MPCA failed to consider narrative standards, sort of full stop. That's not correct. If you look at the addendum, which identifies the specific parameters, for instance, the numeric and narrative standards associated with river eutrophication, you know, the excessive nutrient loading associated with like excess algae and plant growth in waters, those were considered. So the agency absolutely looked at the parameters that were expressly designed to protect the aquatic life uses that the relators are concerned about, the agency took a hard look at the aquatic life effects that are central to this appeal.
Okay, so it wouldn't be, I'm just trying to understand what the positions are here. It's not that if 0.0150 deals with narrative standards, it's the agency isn't arguing that narrative standards are not relevant. It is arguing that it doesn't have to, those indexes don't apply because they serve a different purpose. I guess one of the questions that I have that I assume opposing counsel would say is, where do you find that? Where does it say that? And because 0.0150, for example, was considered in the ballast water case. I mean, it was all the narrative standards in there. So I just wasn't quite understanding the brief whether 0.0150 doesn't apply at all, or it's a choice to whether apply it, or it's portions of it that apply and not all of it. You know what I'm saying?
I believe I follow your question, Your Honor. And I think maybe the best way to answer it is there's a choice. MPCA does exercise its discretion when it chooses which parameters to focus on as part of its 401 review. The locus of 401 review are the anti-degradation standards. Those standards are designed to protect the existing uses of the waters that are going to be affected by the project. And that's what MPCA did here. And so, and I think maybe another way to explain this is each of the specific standards in 7050-222 that MPCA looked at is designed to protect aquatic life uses, right? So aquatic life packs were absolutely considered. The TSS standard itself is designed to protect those uses. MPCA didn't look at the general narrative standard in 7050-150, and that's not a bad thing. I think it's important to understand the numeric criteria are a translation or specific translations of the narrative standards that appear in the state water quality standards. So I think to the extent the relators are arguing that MPCA didn't look at or are using the standard that appears in 7050-150 to say that MPCA somehow ignored aquatic life impacts, that's not correct. I think their claim is actually narrower, that MPCA was required to prepare these indices of biological integrity. That doesn't appear anywhere in the rules. That's not how MPCA interprets that rule. The IBIs are a classification tool. They're not a permitting statute.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Ms. Bressman, you have 7 minutes. And I'm just going to indicate here, in light of the court's extensive questioning, just so you understand, Mr. Strand, I am not going to hold you closely to 5 minutes of rebuttal. If you need more time to address the extra time that was taken to have Mr. Farrell address the issues that he was addressing, as long as your additional comments are related to the court's questions in that regard. So with that, and I thought I'd let you know that ahead of time. With that, Ms. Bressman, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Christy Brisbane, representing respondent Enbridge Energy Limited Partnership. Given the discussion today, I plan on focusing on the merits issues, but I want to just note briefly on the mootness issue that the relators here had the opportunity, a procedural opportunity, to avoid this issue by asking the PCA to stay its decision before the Army Corps of Engineers issued its 404 permit, and they did not do that. Not only did they not do that, they didn't raise this appeal until after the 404 permit had been issued itself. And so again, they had a procedural opportunity to avoid this issue and chose not to do so.
How would a stay by the PCA have stopped the Corps from issuing a 404 certification? Permit, such that it would be, I'm not sure I follow that.
So the 401 is a prerequisite to the Army Corps of Engineers issuing its 404 permit. Had the relators requested a stay of the PCA prior to the issuance of the 404, that would have at least put the Corps on alert that there was an issue with the underlying 401. And in addition, it would have, like the vessel case, been an example of the relators actually using all the judicial process to protect the interests that they were concerned about.
But since it was at the end of the year, I mean, I guess I just wonder, is that's basically assuming the Corps would say, oh, we'll take a pause too. Is that right? Rather than just issue it because the year might be up. Or am I wrong about that? That is there something that would compel the Corps not to issue their 404?
Certainly the one-year clock may have been at issue, but we don't know because the relators didn't use the remedy of asking the state for a stay of the state 401 certification. So again, they had the opportunity to do so to influence the Corps' issuance of the 404, and they didn't take that opportunity. Turning to the merits, if I may, I want to point out that the record that's before you has resulted in what the agency has characterized as one of the most stringent water quality certifications it has ever issued. And relators are asking that this court set aside that record, set aside the agency's technical analysis, and to second guess the agency's application of its water quality regulations. These are highly technical issues, and this court and other recent Minnesota Supreme Court cases have recognized that the court owes deference to the agency decision makers on areas of its expertise and special knowledge in the field of their technical training, education, experience, which is exactly what its issue is at issue here. I want to address the issue of PCA's consideration of its narrative or biological standards, the operational impacts Mr. Strand mentioned, the wetland impacts, and with time, the burden question from Judge Jessen. So the relators are arguing that the PCA refused to consider the biological water quality standards, and I think Mr. Farrell provided a good overview of how those water quality standards work within the broader framework of this 401 certification. But I note, while this is one of the most technical issues in the brief, you only have to put a toe into this record to understand that the agency did consider the biological criteria. I'd point you to page 5 of the findings of fact and order, where it states biological criteria were considered. And then it provides a reasoned explanation of how they were considered. And the protection of aquatic life, which is the underpinning of those biological criteria, was one of the 5 central issues in the contested case hearing. It was discussed at length, along with an analysis of whether there would be temporary or permanent impacts to water quality. And I'd point you to the testimony of Ms. Melissa Tusky from the PCA and Ms. Christine Ethic from Enbridge for details on how those biological criteria were considered. This wasn't picking and choosing. The agency took a hard look at the biological criteria. And further, just to underscore a point that Mr. Farrell made, the IBI analysis in Minnesota Rule 7050-0150 is a classification tool. It's designed to provide the agency with greater information about Class 2 waters. But where the subcategory general use remains the same, which is what all of the waters crossed by this project are general use Class 2 waters, then the water quality management for those streams and rivers are unchanged. And again, the total suspended solid standard, that numeric standard, was specifically developed to be protective of aquatic life. And so being in compliance with the TSS standard as the project is, ensures that that existing use is protected. So again, there's no doubt that the PCA took a hard look at biological criteria. On the issue of operational impacts, I also want to just make a couple of quick points. Mr. Strand has suggested that the agency did not look at operational criteria, but again, all you have to do is look at the agency's final decision, in which on page 1 of the final cert, it notes that they looked at all of the waters crossed that are affected by applicable state water quality standards, and that they considered the Line 3 project as a whole. I also point you to the final certification, where there are numerous conditions related to operational impacts, including conditions 27 to 30 and 34 as examples. So it's clear that the agency's review extended beyond just construction and into operational impacts. The underlying premise also misstates the applicable standard. And if you look at the PUD-1 case, that doesn't require regulation of operations. It allows it once the federal hook for a Section 404 permit has been met. And that's consistent with the code too, which again, once a federal permit requires a 401 certification, then it allows the state that has broad discretion in setting its water quality framework, then it allows those conditions and limitations on activity as a whole. And that's exactly what the PCA did here. Also, I know I have very few moments remaining. I just want to point out on the wetland impacts. Relators have argued that avoidance wasn't done, but I'd point you very specifically that while the PCA didn't consider route alternatives, they did consider a number of ways to avoid impacts within the route designated by the commission. This includes reducing the right-of-way. It includes specific crossing methods. so boring or an HDD under the wetland. It includes seasonal impacts and many other mitigation measures, including use of mats. That's all contained within the record. So certainly there were large and extensive record development around the avoidance of wetland impacts. And just finally, in conclusion, I would note that the record demonstrates that this agency applied its technical knowledge and training and especially to an extensive record and found that with the stringent conditions included in the 401 certification, that there is reasonable assurance that the Line 3 project will meet all applicable water quality standards. And we'd ask that this court affirm the agency decision in all respects.
Judge Flory, if I may.
Go ahead.
Ms. Brisbane, you originally said you weren't going to address my question about the burden of proof. So I want to give you an opportunity to do that because speaking for myself, you know, I am concerned that this may have been improperly shifted. And, you know, from my perspective, the burden of proof should be on the applicant, which is Enbridge. So could you please address that for me?
Thank you, Judge Jessen. I would say that there is no disagreement. Enbridge bore the burden of proof as to the entirety of the support for the 401 application, and we met it. Within the contested case process itself, however, the procedure was that the agency had already issued a draft permit, and relators were asking that agency to make a change. Under the applicable standard, including the case law cited and the rule, in that contested case, the relators had at least the burden of production to bring forward some material that the agency could use to change its decision, and they did not do so. That's what the ALJ found, but the relators did not meet their burden within the contested case on each of those five issues. But it's immaterial to your overall decision, because I don't think there's any question that given the extensive record here, Enbridge fully supported the record evidence needed for the agency to make its final decision on the 401 certification.
All right, thank you, Ms. Brisbane. Mr. Strand, it's your chance for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Yarn. Let me start by addressing the question of deference. Throughout the argument of the respondents, there's the contention that the MPCA's interpretation of its regulations, decision to apply some, not others, its decision to include some considerations, not to include others, is the application of technical expertise. It's not. It's a refusal to apply administrative and technical expertise. With respect to the biological standards, for example, the MPCA has developed a considerable degree of expertise on how to do that. It is very clear in the materials that have been provided by the agency over the years that there's a way to make those assessments of biological integrity. There is nothing in the rules that says that that's just classification. It drives permits, it drives certifications. That's what our water quality standards do. So picking and choosing among which parts of the law you're going to enforce is not the application of technical expertise. It's not a decision that's entitled to deference. It's a decision about what the law means, which is ultimately for this court to decide. So no deference is owed to those decisions. Second, this point that looking at the physical and chemical standards is looking at the biological standards, that the things like the numeric limit for total suspended solids is a translation of the narrative standards. PCA has been very clear that it is not what they are, that the physical and chemical standards, which they've relied on in the past, are a poor proxy for the biological integrity standards that are articulated in 0.0150. And so again, you have a situation where the BCA falls back on what might've been appropriate in the 70s and 80s, ignores the technical development of this particular kinds of assessments, and makes a decision based more on the fact that it would be easy to do rather than the fact that it would give us a much more accurate assessment as to whether or not this project is going to pose a real threat to the aquatic life that the standards are intended to protect. Environmental review. There is no basis to the notion that the agency that is assigned to do environmental review is the agency whose processes are supposed to be completed first and that all of the other agencies then follow. There's nothing that says that. In fact, that's not even in these situations where there's several agencies that are involved, that often is not the case. Sometimes the agency that does the environmental review ends up doing its substantive work last. That's not uncommon at all. The challenge for this court, and which should have been the challenge for the MPCA, is to find a way to give effect to its statute and rules, and at the same time give effect to the PUC's statute and rules, as well as the other agencies that are involved. They didn't do that. They simply concluded as a matter of law that their obligation to evaluate whether or not there are feasible and prudent alternatives was taken away from them by the PUC decision. That's a legal conclusion. It's not a technical decision. That's a purely legal decision, and something that we think is basic is just wrong, and something that this court can reverse. Redressability. Going back to that line of questioning, I mean, and I think back to Judge Jessen's original question. I mean, this is about redressability. Is there something that we get out of this, that we would get out of a ruling that this 401 certification is invalid, that is worth something more than zero? Judge Jessen asked me for a case. I can't for the life of me think of the name, but I'm thinking of the standing case in the US Supreme Court just last term, where the court again recognized that even a tiny injury in fact can be a basis for establishing standing. So there's no basis for the idea that the value of the relief that can be obtained has to reach some kind of a threshold before the court can review the substance. I concede we don't know for sure what the courts might do ultimately with a decision that the 401 is invalid. All we can offer is that we know that the 401 certification is a precondition. You eliminate the precondition, we think you eliminate the permits. We think that's a very clear statement of the law. We think that has enormous value to us, and we think it's something that would really makes the 401 certification process valuable. We have a very strong presumption of reviewability in Minnesota, particularly for administrative agency decisions. It's difficult to overcome that presumption, and concern that we don't know for sure what the Corps will do, what the federal court will do, shouldn't be a basis for denying access to getting the Court of Appeals to decide these legal questions. The issue of a stay.
Go ahead. I was going to ask you, I do want to hear about that, though, but I was going to ask you about the burden of proof. The rule that was invoked with respect to the burden of proof was that the rule 1400-7300, which is that the party proposing that certain action be taken must prove the facts by preponderance of the evidence in a contested case hearing. And that the certain action, as I understood the MPCA's argument, that the certain action that was being proposed here is changing the draft certification that had issued. How is this, and how could you distinguish our earlier published decision where we said the burden of proof was in fact on the challenger to a draft permit in a contested case, the MCEA case from 2005?
Well, a couple of responses. First of all, I mean, the basic question is whether or not the document that has the caption draft on it is enough to shift the burden of proof. Our position is that it isn't. I think Enbridge concedes that the burden of proof remains with them throughout the process. They suggested that we have an obligation to meet some kind of burden of production. I think the record indicates that we certainly met that. We thought we met the burden of persuasion if it was going to be laid on us. But certainly we've had a burden of production, which would have kept the burden of proof on all those separate issues. If the PCA had decided to have a contested case before issuing a draft permit, there wouldn't have been any question at all about whether or not the burden of proof would shift. And so it really kind of comes down to whether or not that single document shifts the burden. I'm not so sure that the previous decision involving, I think that was a 402 permit, was necessarily correctly decided, but it certainly shouldn't be extended to the analysis necessary under Section 401 and under the state's rules governing rule or Section 401 certifications. It is embedded in the broader question of when does the where should the risk of non-persuasion lie? And we think throughout this process, whether it comes to the specific issues that the ALJ considered, the broader set of issues that were involved in this case, the consideration of what impact the year has, all of those, in all those situations, the risk of non-persuasion should be on the applicant. And I think that's a principle of law that this court should adopt. You know, the stay argument, I don't think gets us anywhere. You know, we were at the end of the year. There was the PCA, I think, was very conscious of somebody making an argument. I guess that would be Enbridge, that if they had not had an effective decision within the year, that they will have waived their authority to do the 401 certification. So to suggest that somehow the PCA could buy additional time and still avoid the waiver issue by granting some kind of a stay just isn't correct. You know, we asked for the stay where the rubber hits the road, which is where the 404 permits are. We were not successful in the federal court. You know, we'll see how the federal court, you know, resolves that issue, but granting a stay would not have changed the situation. It would have only increased the odds that there'd be another basis for concluding that the state no longer had the authority to decide whether or not the project would comply with state water quality standards. That wouldn't have made any sense for any of the parties that are involved in there in this. I want to address finally, maybe the question of operational risks. Let me go back to reviewability for a second. You were asking about the cases. I think it's important. Our brief explains this, that the MCA case was quite distinguishable because the regulations that apply to 402 permits simply are different. I just think that, and that was also a situation where the state was attempting to add conditions after it had already waived certification. So those are completely different facts, completely different rules, and it really doesn't have any application here.
So just so you know, Mr. Strand, we're 10 minutes into rebuttal at this point, and which is twice the normal under the rules. So I'll give you 2 minutes to sum up here.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. And I've been trying to limit the stuff that came up in the questionings. I'll just finish the point about those cases. The other case is the one that came out of the one of the Texas courts of appeal. I think they have 9 of them down there in Texas, but one of them, you know, came up with that conclusion that if you weren't able to get to court before the 404 permits came out, you were off luck. We just think that's bad law. That's not how the proposition should work. That would make 401 certifications essentially unreviewable, which is directly contrary to the presumption applies here. So we think there's adequate injury. In fact, there's adequate evidence that a favorable decision would redress those injuries in some way. And that's enough to justify this court going forward and deciding these issues on the merits. So with that, unless there are more questions, I'll stop there.
All right, seeing none, thank you to all counsel here for your helpful arguments today. You know, I think a case like this demonstrates the challenge that we have in the short time that's allowed under our rules for arguments, and we've certainly relaxed that to some degree today, which I think is understandable with 50,000 pages of record and hundreds of pages of brief and addenda. Your briefing and addenda also greatly helps us in analyzing the case, and we appreciate your thorough briefing. But with that, we will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we will issue a decision on the issues here within the statutory time frame. We stand adjourned. Thank you.